It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing quite well.
Very good. Let's got lots to cover as usual, and we're going to start out with National.
Sure.
Okay. Very good. Scooter Libby appears to be...
The president is a hypocrite. Who would have guessed?
I'm shocked.
I know. It'll just bring listeners to this program to a complete halt, I'm sure. But, we learned this week on Wednesday afternoon, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald filed papers with the court in D.C., saying that, among other things, Scooter Libby had given testimony to Fitzgerald and to the grand jury that both Vice President Dick Cheney and President George Bush had given their explicit approval to the leaking of classified national intelligence estimate intelligence on Iraq, selected intelligence, of course, estimate information that would buttress the administration's case for a preemptive invasion. This in response to critics of the war who were saying at the time, this in summer of 2003, that no weapons of mass destruction had been found. The administration had been lying in order to make its case to go to war. You know, all the things that we've since found out to be true. But there were several other things about this revelation that were quite interesting, above and beyond the fact that the president authorized a leak. And of course, this is it's certainly not the first time that a president or an administration has authorized a leak of classified information for political purposes. But it stands out for two reasons. One is that this administration and Bush in particular has been on the warpath, especially in recent months, over people in the federal government under his control who leak classified information. They've had scores of people in the intelligence services, the CIA, et cetera, take polygraph tests. CIA and State Department have been scoured for evidence of leakers. They've urged launched investigations and repeatedly urged prosecution of the whistleblowers who came forward on both the NSA spying scandal and the revelation of the existence of CIA gulag in Eastern Europe, et cetera. This is a president who has said many times that nobody in administration leaks, that he would get to the bottom of the leaks in the Valerie Plame affair, that et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the number of statements, public statements by Bush that are contradicted by this revelation are extraordinary. But above and beyond that, and more interesting, though, now the White House has not denied any of Fitzgerald's information. What they're saying instead is very interesting. It's the rationale, once again, for the president being above the law. They are claiming that Bush had the authority to declassify these documents for the National Intelligence Estimate all on his own. They didn't have – some of these the NEI documents on Iraq were declassified only 10 days later. So it wasn't information that, was a great state secret or anything like that. The Bush administration wanted this stuff out, obviously. But it was classified at the time. And why go through the process of formally declassifying it if the president had already done so? The argument of the White House is, well, the president declassified it by giving the verbal authorization to go ahead and leak it. By saying that it could be released to the public, the president therefore declassified it. What they're saying, in other words, is that the president, by definition, cannot leak classified information, because as soon as he leaks it, it's no longer classified information. Or as soon as he decides to leak it, it's no longer classified information. So that what they're saying, once again, is that the president, by definition, cannot break the law. It's like saying that the president cannot break a law countenance somebody in his administration breaking a law that Congress has passed, for example, the ban on torture, because as soon as the president decides that that ban is no longer appropriate, the law no longer applies. Or the same thing with reporting to Congress results of the Patriot Act reauthorization, or any number of other things where in various signing statements he said that he's above the law. This, once again, is an argument for a White House that does not answer to either the courts or to Congress, or for that matter, to the American public. It's an argument for a dictatorship, and virtually nobody has called him on that. The other thing that was interesting that has not been emphasized about the Fitzgerald revelation is that not only did Cheney and Bush authorize the leak of the NEI information on Iraq, but Bush was receiving regular updates on the ongoing efforts to discredit Joseph Wilson, and presumably that includes the unmasking of his wife, Valerie Wilson, as a covert CIA operative. At minimum, we now know that there was an ongoing orchestrated conspiracy to discredit and smear Joseph Wilson in order, again, to discredit the case against the invasion of Iraq, and that that effort was up to and including George Bush, and that as with the question of the classified information goes against a number of public statements that Bush has made. The interesting question about this is what Bush, when he was talking to Patrick Fitzgerald's investigators early on in the investigation in 2004, what he told them. Because sources close to the case, at least according to Jason Leopold of Truthout, who's been following the case pretty closely and has had a lot of these scoops before the mainstream media has, is saying that Bush denied both, that he denied leaking the classified information and he denied knowing anything about an effort to discredit Joseph Wilson in talking with Fitzgerald's investigators and in giving testimony. So he may have been caught in some whoppers, not just in what he told the public, but in what he told law enforcement as well. And that could get him in some trouble.
All right, moving along. You really couldn't tune to a news show this week and not catch them talking about immigration as a major issue this week. And yet the immigration bill that was in the Senate looks like it's not going anywhere.
Not anytime soon. A number of things this week happened in Congress. Congress now adjourning for a two-week Easter recess. They come home and get to hear from people. The immigration thing, of course, was very hot, and the tension in the Senate, as with the House, was between Republicans who wanted a guest worker program that favored big corporations that wanted cheap exploitable labor, and the xenophobes who didn't want illegal immigration at all, or didn't want immigration at all, certainly not of unskilled workers. There was a compromise that was reached at the last minute on Friday in the Senate that favored the guest worker program, as well as providing a route to amnesty for the 10 million or so immigrants already in this country illegally. Then that compromise fell apart over various procedural maneuvering between Democrats and Republicans. And it looks like that just because of the timing of the upcoming election, the momentum, certainly the huge demonstrations being mounted and pressure being mounted by the immigrant community and its supporters themselves, who have not been heard very well in this debate at all and certainly are not represented by either of the major options being considered in Congress. It argues against the Senate making much progress against on this again this year. They still could. The bill was actually referred back to the Judiciary Committee, so it could still move forward. And remember that the House has already passed its own very draconian bill that has all sorts of nasty measures in it. So the pressure is still very much on. There's a national day of action on immigrant rights, I believe it's called, to defend immigrant rights, on Monday. There'll be a local action on that, and we'll talk about that at the end of the program. That's what happened in immigrant rights, and it's not likely to revisit us soon. But there are some other interesting things going on this week as well. Passed out of the House Resource Committee is a bill that should have gotten a lot of attention here in the Northwest, but has not. It's basically a new salvage logging rider bill that is very, very bad. Something called the Forest Emergency Recovery and Research Act, also known as H.R. 4200, being pushed by Greg Walden, the Republican from Oregon, who is the single leading recipient of timber industry money in the Congress. He got over $100,000 in I think it was 2004 was the last year for which it's been reported. But his bill would, quote, mandate logging after natural disturbances like fires, droughts and windstorms. The bill would exempt salvage logging from every relevant environmental law, including the Endangered Species Act. The bill includes no protections for old growth reserves, roadless forests, salmon streams, or any other sensitive areas. So it's actually even more extreme than salvage logging measures that we've had in the past, and it's definitely something that people should be paying attention to here in the Northwest, because as we've seen before with salvage logging measures that go through Congress, they can frequently be used not just after natural disasters like forest fires, but anytime the timber industry claims, well, there's dying trees in a forest. Well, any forest has dying trees, because some trees grow and some trees die, and it's called a life cycle. So bills like that are not only abusive in and of themselves, but they can also be abused in terms of their definition of what constitutes salvage logging. The House approved this week, under along party lines, 218-209, a very bad campaign finance bill that basically is a bill designed to give electoral advantage to Republicans. The Republicans all voted for it. The Democrats all voted against it. What it does is a couple of fairly technical things. It lifts any kind of limits on contributions that can be made to political parties for spending in coordination with candidates. That's something Republicans do much more often than Democrats. And it puts a strict cap on something called a 527, which is something that came up in the last electoral cycle that Democrats used 4-1 more than Republicans, which is a nonprofit that gets set up to funnel donations into campaign efforts. Very much a partisan bill, very much designed to provide electoral advantage to Republicans, and we'll see where it goes in the Senate. And then last but not least, there was a very interesting study that came out this week. It's the first study that's really been done of the 2003 tax cuts that Bush pushed through the Republican Congress on investment income, the tax cuts on investment income, which we talked about in this program, that they would very much favor the wealthy. You would expect that they would, because it's primarily the wealthy that rely heavily on investment income. But nobody had ever really studied it. Well, it turns out that for Americans who have an income of greater than $10 million a year, and I'm sure that includes many people out there listening today, the average tax savings per year by these tax cuts was approximately $500,000. So it did its job very well. And what that does to the Treasury and the ability of Congress to, for example, pay for social spending programs, that's just another side benefit of the tax cuts as far as the Republicans are concerned.
So what are you going to do with your leftover $500,000?
I was thinking of investing it in oil.
Oh, that's always a safe bet. All right. It looks like the White House has some plans for new nukes.
Yeah. This was something that Bush sent Congress this week, specifically Strategic Subcommittee of the House Armed Services Committee, a new plan to upgrade and update the country's nuclear weapons complex. Most of it dates from the Cold War. The stockpile of thousands of nuclear weapons that the United States still maintains, many of them on here, trigger alert. Many of them were built decades ago. It's expensive to maintain and provide security for the arsenal, etc. So what the Bush administration wants to do is build a whole bunch of new nukes, and not only that, but consolidate and modernize the nuclear weapons production facility. Now, it's not entirely clear why we need all of these new nukes. The Bush administration wants to put in place a plan that would have us producing 125 new nuclear weapons every year, beginning in the year 2022. And naturally, they didn't put any kind of a price tag on this, and naturally, they didn't talk at all about privatization, but I'm sure that's down the road also. Maybe we can have some company from the United Arab Emirates do it. But this is a plan that is now afloat in Congress. Keep an eye on it, because for people who are concerned about nuclear weapons, for people who don't see any point in nuclear weapons now that the Soviet Union has been defunct for 17 years, this is not only yet another corporate welfare set up for the military industrial complex, but it's also very, very dangerous. And it's, you know, it's a form of political and military blackmail against the rest of the world.
And they still can't figure out what to do with the old nuclear material. I know the
just
this week
they
had
no
another
idea.
Report on the classification plan over in Hanford that the price continues to skyrocket.
And, yes.
All right. Well, the Pentagon this week looked into their databases or their crystal ball or whatever and found there's some peace groups in there.
Yeah, imagine that. Folks may have noticed that we keep getting these revelations of various arms of the federal government spying on peace groups. We had another one this week. It's become so common now that it's not even big news anymore. But this was back to the Pentagon again. Now, remember in December, there was a revelation originally by NBC News that several hundred peace groups in the United States had been spied upon by something called Talon, the threat and level something or rather, yada yada, and kept in a database of terrorist threats, even though that information was supposed to be erased from the database after 90 days. Never mind why it was even there in the first place. Well, the Pentagon dutifully agreed to erase the information from their database, which they presumably have done, and also launched a review to see if they could find any more peace groups. Well, Wednesday, they came out with the information that 260 more peace groups had been spied upon by the Pentagon. Now, this has nothing to do with the spying by the anti-terrorism task forces in various parts of the country, or the NSA monitoring program, or any of those things. This is the Talon program. This is the Pentagon. 260 more peace groups. We don't know which ones. Hopefully we'll find out sometime soon, because as I mentioned in this program a week or two ago, the ACLU has launched lawsuits in a number of states, including Washington State, on behalf of some 150 different peace groups to try and find out exactly which peace groups the Pentagon was spying upon, how extensive the spying was, what information was kept, what the rationale was, and to what extent that spying was coordinated with local law enforcement agencies, and to what extent it might be ongoing today.
All right. And finally, on national, Massachusetts seems to be fairly progressive with its health care.
Yeah, the same day, oddly enough, that Bush was next door in Connecticut trying to sell his self-health savings account, which exactly three people in the White House and maybe a couple dozen more in the insurance industry think is a good idea. Nobody else really cares. But at the same time, next door in Massachusetts, the state legislature passed and the governor has said he will sign the country's first ever essentially universal health care insurance plan. It has a little bit of something for everybody. What it does basically is require that everybody in the state by July of next year purchase health care coverage. It makes it illegal not to have it, just like it's illegal not to have auto insurance. But it also provides money for people who can't afford it to buy it. So it has the ability to help lower-income folks get that insurance, which is something that Democrats want. It has an element of personal responsibility, which is something Republicans want. And, of course, it has private insurance, which is something the insurance companies wanted. So this is a model that maybe other states could look at. 95% of the uninsured people in Massachusetts, it's estimated, will be covered by this plan. It'll be less than 1% of the population in the state that is uninsured after this takes hold. So it looks like the type of compromise that may be able to succeed where the federal government has failed so miserably.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's jump to international. Iraq was even busier than usual this week.
Yeah, a lot going on in and around and having to do with Iraq. 900 sectarian killings in the last month was the count that folks came up with at the end of March. This, of course, the first full month after the Samra bombing of February 22nd. There is no doubt with that kind of a death toll that civil war is underway. I mean, there's simply no debate about it. 900 people in the population of Iraq would be the equivalent of 11,000 people dying in the United States between one one particular group and another particular group, say Democrats and Republicans. It would be you only need that kind of a death rate for 4 months in order to get the entire death toll from 30 years of sectarian violence in Northern Ireland. So clearly things are bad and getting worse in Iraq, and civil war is already on our hands. There was more tension between the United States and the Shiite majority that's running the current government and trying to form a new government in Iraq. Ibrahim al-Jafari, under tremendous pressure from the United States and Britain, Jack Straw and Condoleezza Rice, both in Baghdad, pressuring the Shiites, pressuring the Iraqis to get al-Jafari to step aside and get the Shiites to agree to form some sort of a national unity government that includes secular politicians as well as Kurds and Sunnis. And al-Jafari is refusing. The Shiites are increasingly angry at the heavy-handedness of the United States. Of course, what they see is the United States thinking democracy in the Middle East is all fine and well as long as it results in the people running the country that they want them to, and otherwise they simply have no use for it. We're starting to see a real schism between the United States government and the government of Iraq. John Kerry coming out this week, for example, and suggesting a May 15th deadline that if Iraq does not form a government of the United States liking that as a unity government by then, that the United States would withdraw its troops. Which would be a good idea, but not for that particular reason. Several revelations about spending in Iraq this week. While Ayatollah Alawi was prime minister in 2004-2005, all $1.3 billion set aside for defense procurement simply disappeared, it turns out. That's one reason why the United States is having to pour so much money feels it has to pour so much money into training police and army and getting equipment for them now for the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army. Of course, a lot of that is just going into the sectarian militias that control the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army. Now the United States wants to put Ayatollah, it turns out, to become some sort of a super minister that would be in charge of security for the country. Alawi being one of the country's only semi-credible secular leaders, and that again is something they're trying to impose on the Shiites. The Shiites really strongly resent. We had a report in the Beirut Daily News this week that as part of the privatization that the United States has imposed upon the Iraqi government and the IMF has and so forth in exchange for debt forgiveness for debts incurred under Saddam Hussein and so on. Of course, a tremendous privatization program launched by the Bush administration as soon as the invasion happened. One of the little reported effects of that, the budget for food rations is down from $4 billion to $3 billion this year. That is the food that is handed out to the very poorest of people in Iraq to prevent starvation. That budget is being cut by 25%, and those people are being left, of course, to the open market. We had a report in the Washington Post on Wednesday that the Bush budget, both for this year, for the year that's for some agencies that are coming to an end of their funding at the end of this month, and for the upcoming FY 2007 budget, that the Bush administration has essentially sharply reduced or ended almost all funding for the development of democratic institutions in Iraq. That is, developing the civic institutions that are sort of the building blocks of democracy. The Bush administration is giving a lot of rhetoric towards toward democracy in Iraq, but it is not funding actual development of democracy in Iraq. That's something that has certainly not gotten very much attention. And then last but not least, we had John Reed, the British Ministry of Defense, coming out this week and saying that the Geneva Conventions and various other international laws were outdated and should be, quote, revamped. Now, this is something that the Bush administration has not concerned itself much with because it doesn't believe in the Geneva Conventions or international law. But for those of our squeamish allies who might, like the Brits, but who are still torturing prisoners and abusing prisoners like the Brits are, this is their solution, is to actually reform the Geneva Conventions themselves, because they are no longer applicable in a time of in a time of asymmetrical warfare, presumably. So that that was certainly met with a lot of alarm by human rights groups and various other folks concerned. At the same time, a British government report came out very quietly this week that acknowledged for the first time that the July 7th, 2005 bombings in London last summer that were launched by suicide bombers who were residents of Britain were directly motivated by the war in Iraq. This is something that Tony Blair and his government have steadfastly denied, that Britain's involvement in Iraq could redound to any kind of terrorist attacks upon Britain itself. And it has implications for the United States as well, because if Britain can suffer for homegrown attacks because of the war in Iraq from Muslims and other people outraged by their government's conduct in Iraq, it can certainly happen here as well. And it's certainly a security threat that is posed because of our country's ongoing involvement in Iraq.
And, of course, they'd found out previously as well the attacks on July 7th had no connections to al-Qaeda at all.
So, yes, that's quite correct.
Very quickly, give us an update on what's going on with Iran.
Yeah, a couple of things. There was a report Friday in the Financial Times that Iran is all ready to talk about its nuclear weapons program with the United States, as well as Iraq and national security. But the United States now not only wants to limit any diplomatic talks to Iraq and Iraq only, but it is now walking away from even those talks. A State Department spokesman on Friday said those talks are on hold and the Bush administration has no plans to pursue them. So the United States is not interested in negotiating at all with Iran, even on items of mutual concern and interest, even though Iran is. That says an awful lot about the Bush administration's intentions toward Iran. And, of course, there was a lot of the usual saber-rattling this week as well.
All right. Events.
Several of interest this weekend and in coming days. Later this afternoon, for folks who missed Marco Zanaga and Jerome Armstrong of Daily Kos and MyDD, respectively, they were at the Labor Temple, packed house last night. It was very good. But if you missed that, they will be at Merrymore Park this afternoon in Redmond from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's at 6046 West Lake Sammamish Parkway, northeast in Redmond. Tomorrow evening, Kevin Phillips, author of the book American Theocracy, which has gotten a lot of very good reviews, is in town. He'll be at Town Hall tomorrow night at 7:30 o'clock, part of the American Voices series that Foolproof is putting on. And then on Monday, as I mentioned, is the National Day of Action to Defend Immigrant Rights. Here in Seattle, there will be a march at 3:30 in the afternoon, starting at St. Mary's Church and heading downtown. That march will hopefully get to downtown just in time for rush hour, and there will be a rally at the federal building probably around 5 o'clock in downtown Seattle, 2nd and Madison.
And St. Mary's Church is at 611 South 20th Street.
Yes.
And then as well today from 6 to 9 is the Aaron Dixon campaign kickoff at Garfield Community Center. So,
yes, with Elaine Brown, I believe, is coming for that.
I believe you're correct. Talking once again with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple weeks, a free newspaper of local as well as global and international news. We didn't even get the local news this week. There's a lot of it, though. And you can also find it in bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, all sorts of good places. You can also find it on the web, current issue, as well as all back issues, the blog, et cetera, www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments, questions, tips, you want information, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947. And look for details coming soon, but we'll be hosting a benefit by David Barsamian on Sunday, the 30th of April, 2 weeks from tomorrow.